Hey, everybody, welcome back. Thank you very much for tuning in. You are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. My name is Colin. I am once again back with Dom to talk more about Big Brother 7. Dom, how are you?
I'm doing well, and I'm looking forward to talking about this week. It's a big week in the context of Big Brother All-Stars. It's the first week that someone other than a Season 6 member wins HOH, and it's always a question to see what that person's going to do with it, especially when that person is Danielle, who came into the season as maybe one of the most iconic players other than obviously Will and a handful of others. So a big week, and they certainly didn't let us down.
Yeah, definitely. Very exciting to finally, as you've mentioned, get someone outside of that Season 6 alliance in power for once. And I guess we should, right off the top of the podcast, issue the spoiler alert warning a little late on that. I guess we've spoiled the first 6 weeks, but if you've been listening to our previous podcast, you already know how all of those went. We will, though, be talking about in full detail how this entire season plays out, and frankly, any season of Big Brother and or Survivor, honestly, is probably fair game in these podcasts, I would say. So be caught up on both of those shows if you're going to continue.
Yeah, also going to spoil The Genius, Society Game, The Voice, shows that we haven't even watched yet. Nothing is safe, okay? So know what you're getting yourself in for when you listen to this.
Right, exactly. And Dom, as you just mentioned, or I guess as I also just mentioned as well, we had a lot just going on in our previous episodes as well, in case anyone missed those. And most recently, we talked week 4 with BB14 winner Ian Terry. He, of course, had a lot to say about Boogie and Janelle, given all of the experience he had with them on his own season. That was a lot of fun. If you missed that, definitely do go back and check that out. Dom, I think we are good, though, to dive into week 5. And as you mentioned, we need a new head of household now. Janelle, not one of the best weeks of her career, actually, as Ian described it. One of the worst spent HOH weeks in the history of Big Brother. And I don't think I would disagree with that. So good to move on and just kind of forget that all of that happened for season 6 and for everyone else.
And I remember, even though as I was watching the season for the first time, thinking, Janella's really botching this HOH week, and I don't know if or when this is going to come back to bite her, but we're going to find out. And it turns out it's going to come sooner rather than later, especially as this, to me, seemed like the kind of competition that she would be incredibly well suited for. And we floated the idea last week, and Janelle, in fact, floated the idea during that week of, what if she just throws this competition to Marcellus?
Right.
So he wins, probably goes after Chilltown, and then she's free to play and on her own behalf and on behalf of Season 6. And this seems like the kind of competition where, like, if you had to bet on Janelle versus the field, Janelle, I don't know if you're betting against Janelle there. Like, she has pretty good odds. But instead, she is forced to watch from the sidelines as probably the biggest active threat to Season 6, wins HOH and then has power for the week.
Right, exactly. We have this spider web competition where it starts out that everyone gets to be on top of this giant rotating spider web, and they get this foam sprayed on them throughout the course of the competition, later gratuitously called spider sperm by Will and Howie as they were trying to pass the time.
Of course.
Yeah, of course, you can't, this is not a family show back in these days, Dom. We're not, the target demographic isn't 9-year-olds back in this era of Big Brother.
And Will and Harry are both, smart, sober adult men, certainly not just overgrown mound children by any stretch of the imagination.
Right. Well, everyone's going to start out on top of the web for the first 2 hours, and then they have to start hanging from the web on the second 2 hours. And actually, Will is the only person who ends up dropping in that initial 2-hour period. And the reason that he gives is that he, first of all, wanted an egg. And what he's referencing is the first 5 people down from this spider web get to draw one of the 5 eggs that they get to smash open an egg, and inside one of those eggs will be either a prize or it will be a rotten egg. There are 3 prizes and then just 2 rotten eggs with nothing in them. The prizes are $10,000 cash. There's also a week-long slot pass and also the right to cancel an eviction vote that round, specifically that round. I think a little more valuable if you could use it anytime you want, but still a cool power nonetheless. Will doesn't really put in much of an effort here. He gets an egg. His egg happens to be rotten, but furthermore, Dom, and another, I think, good reason for Will wanting to drop here when he sees this is going to go a long time is no one is going to be there to interrupt him from talking privately with Janelle for as long as they get to stay on top of the spider web. He's going to get alone time with Janelle to straighten things out after completely turning the tables on her in her own HOH the previous week.
Yeah, and I don't think that she was really blindsided by what happened. This was something which she convinced herself was the right move to do by the end. So I don't know how much he actively needed to straighten out. I think it was more a case of, if there is anything, then this is by far the best opportunity to do it. And I want to do it before a season six member wins HOH, so it doesn't look like I'm just sucking up to the power once again.
And he also says, quote, "I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I'm not going to sit on a spider web for 50 hours to get a rotten egg." And I think Will, like we always go back to, I think a decent percentage of Will truly just doesn't care about winning these competitions, like game completely aside. You could tell him that it would be better for his game, and he wouldn't care. Yeah.
But this only adds to the mystique around Dr. Will and competitions for me, because if he was trying to win it, he seems like he wouldn't have that bad a shot in this challenge in particular.
I think this challenge, well, go ahead.
I was going to say, for someone like Will, a challenge where you just have to sit around and do nothing seems like the perfect setup.
Yeah, I think this challenge, once they have to start hanging upside down, it's incredibly impressive to me that Howie managed to stay in there as long as he did, being such a big guy. And granted, he's a pretty strong big guy, too. But this seems to me
like...
He's a big boy, that's exactly right. But this seems to me... like it was often going to come down to the smaller women if they were the ones who wanted to win it. I think it's a complete story checks out that we end up with Danielle and Erica here as the last two hanging up on the web as if nothing in the world is bothering them.
Yeah, and Janelle certainly wanted to win it, and based on what you're saying and just her overall challenge prowess, she certainly would have been one of the favorites here. But again, she doesn't have that opportunity because she chose to win last week in a spot where maybe she didn't quite have to.
Right, and I think that's kind of the problem, is we talk about how foolish people like Janelle are for not wanting to throw these competitions, and frankly, it led to... while it was kind of a down week compared to most of the rest of BB7, still, by modern standards, I would say a really entertaining HOH week where things kind of get flipped on their head and Diane, of all people, ends up being the one who leaves. I think that wouldn't happen in the modern era where someone in Janelle's position would have known days ahead of time, oh, of course I'm going to throw it if it comes down to me and Marcellus. Like, the idea of throwing has become such a prevalent thing, and I know I was one of the big advocates for it back when we first started doing this podcast, but certainly for me on Big Brother, it's gotten out of hand how throwing literate every single person is, to the point that I think that we talked about it in a recent podcast, I don't remember which, like I think it was the one with Liana, where we were talking about like how to tweak it now that people have figured out so much about throwing and about backdooring, etc. I think one idea is like let everyone play veto and really make competitions matter again.
It is one of those ideas that has become so firmly embedded in the Big Brother vernacular that these people who come to the show, even without any kind of super fan background, people who maybe watch one or two seasons, have a very faint idea of what the game's about or what's going on, even they know what throwing challenges is and what it means and why people like to do it. And part of that is it's a very intuitive idea, right? Like, do I want to win this competition? Not necessarily. Like, you don't need to have like this education or grounding in Big Brother to work that out. At the same time, like, You see these people coming to the show now who, like, they know that throwing challenges is a done thing, so that's just what they do, regardless of whether it's actually a smart idea for that week or not.
Right, and what the most they're going to go is 1 week without seeing 10 people throw the second HOH challenge or whatever. Like, it's not going to be a well-kept secret, even if it is something they don't have explicitly brought up to them.
And I know Janelle floated the idea as her previous week was unraveling around her, and I think that's what it took to make her even consider the idea of throwing a challenge. But it's one thing for someone like Janelle, being the type of competitor that she is and that she identifies as, to say, oh, maybe I should have thrown that challenge just as a throwaway line. And it's another thing to actually do that in the moment when you're someone who could be claiming the fourth straight week of power on behalf of your group. So it's certainly not surprising that she doesn't throw it, and understandable that as Janelle she doesn't, but you do wonder, like, if she had, maybe this week and then future weeks and then weeks after those all turn out differently.
Well, yeah, on that, along those lines, I'd like to issue a correction that Marcellus, I've been saying, was tight with the season sixers. I've been told he was mostly just tight with Janelle, but still, when it's down to the two of them in that quiz competition, regardless of what kind of streak you want to maintain for season six, I would argue even a slightly thinking player would go into that competition knowing, once they see it's a quiz, okay, if it's me, if it's down to me and someone else, when I'm Janelle and I'm the baddest competition beast that Big Brother has ever seen, frankly, to this point, of course I'm going to throw it. It should be a critical part of any HOH competition strategy for her is selective throwing, knowing when it's better to make sure she can compete the following week. And this is as clear as it gets, as far as I'm concerned, is in terms of even a slightly thinking player would recognize, of course I let Marcellus take it right here.
And the fact that she is such a good competitor and that she is one of the all-time great challenge players across all of Big Brother, that's an even better argument for knowing when to throw it and actually following through on that. Because like the one downside that's built into the game that you have to face is that if you win HOH 1 week, you can't play for it again the next week. And so like you need to be very sure that, okay, it makes sense for me to win it now, given that I actually stand a pretty good chance in the dark of winning it next week if I don't do that. Right. Like if it's someone who once in a blue moon is going to win HOH and they throw it, well, that doesn't really matter because they're not really sacrificing anything the next week. Whereas Janelle, if she wins, right, that's potentially a trade-off that she has to be thinking about. It's like, well, either I win this week or I have a very good shot of winning next week. So it's you see what I'm getting at here. Like it's
right, right. The thought process should be when it's down to her and Marcellus at just the end of this quiz competition, this is the reality of the situation. They're both going to be there at the end of that week. One of them is not going to be able to compete in the following HOH competition. Who do we want that person to be? Like, which of us would we rather have eligible in the following week's competition? That person should throw it 100% of the time. And this is something that even like the Codys and Jessicas, I guess those are both people who watch the show entering their season, but at least somewhat. Jessica, I would imagine much more so than Cody, but this is stuff even complete newbies get right all the time on modern seasons of Big Brother. And these, Janelle in particular, was at this point widely regarded as one of the best players ever to play the game. And frankly, I would say still is widely regarded as one of the best players to play the game. And it is stuff like this, not only winning that HOH herself, using that, like setting aside that she ended up using it to evict Diane instead and just angering her entire alliance to the point that it implodes upon itself in the week that we're about to dive into, and setting aside that she ends up the following week getting HOH again and inadvertently evicting Marcellus, one of her best friends in the game. This should be, like we both laid out already, fundamental stuff for someone like Janelle, where competitions are such a big piece of her game. She should know, okay, if it gets down to me and the right group of people, of course I'm better off throwing. And she does not. And I've been a big arguer against Janelle in general. When it comes to like, it blows my mind that she is regarded as one of the all-time great, just Big Brother players. I completely understand putting her in there as like the Aussie, if we want to frame it in terms of competitions or whatever. But this is such a straightforward thing to get right, and it didn't even cross her mind until everything had crumbled around her.
Maybe Janelle should just never win HOH just to save herself from herself, right? Like it feels like, okay, she gets this 1 week of safety, but in return, she guarantees that in future weeks, the risk to her is that much higher because when she's in power, she somehow manages to alienate every single person who she doesn't already have this connection with. And I know I said last week that I was going to really go into detail on that this week. I think I'm going to save that so I have time to unearth all of these clips because I have receipts. This is a real clip show I can put on here for why everyone somehow comes around to hating Janelle, even completely disproportionately, because you can understand why people would get annoyed by her or why they might resent her in the game or whatever. But there's just like this visceral loathing for her among like half of the cast and half the people outside her own season that somehow manages to develop even, you know, despite her own best efforts. And it's kind of bizarre to see.
Well, I think we do. Let's dive into just this element of it quickly, because I just brought up Janelle as like the Aussie of the show, and it frankly seems like that has become such a popular archetype, and a lot of the characters who have taken this path of just comp whoring from pillar to post have gone on to actually do really well and be historically well-liked players, like the Donatos, Dick and Danielle, or like Rachel Riley. These are people who've gone on to win the game playing this strategy, regardless of how much production interference you want to talk about went into that. But I'm looking right now, Dom, at Janelle, the competition results for the course of this season, and Janelle won HOH or POV all but one of the rounds up until the final three, where obviously she didn't win the final HOH and was evicted. But the only rounds where Janelle was not one of if not both, HOH and POV or POV holder, were weeks 2 and 3, where she had Kacer and James in there as the head of household and was completely safe. She wins week 4 HOH, she wins week 5 POV, she wins week 6 HOH. She in week 7 is the only time I would say Janelle is truly vulnerable, and that is the first part of week 7 where George is the random HOH, and she just luck boxes, I would say, that he doesn't want to do it to someone who's like that prominent of a figure within the franchise. And then she runs the table from there up until final 3, where she finally is vulnerable and gets evicted.
Yeah, so it's, on one level, it's impressive that someone with as big a target on her back as she has is able to make such deep runs in both of her seasons, or, well, both of her first 2 seasons, at least. And then you look at it the other way, and it's, well, the one time she was actually vulnerable, truly vulnerable, she gets taken down, and there's nothing she can really do about it because she is such an obvious target. Everyone else knows what the deal is. So it feels almost kind of deterministic in that as soon as she loses a challenge, she is going to be in the hot seat, and unless you have something on the order of George randomly winning HOH and all of these external factors coming into play, which I'm sure we'll get to during, I think it's week 7, week 8, whichever one George's HOH is. Unless you have those weird circumstances coming into play, Janelle is going to have to save herself. And we really haven't seen her be able to do that so far. And
right.
And when she didn't have that same fortress around her in the form of season 6, she the one time her name comes up, she's just out the door immediately.
Right.
So,
we'll go on to see, like, this week she is nominated and is the target and wins power of veto. This is the first of 4 times going forward that that's going to happen for her. Later on, when Boogie is HOH, she wins the veto to save herself. When Erica is HOH, she wins the veto to save herself. And then at Final 4, she wins the Final 4 POV to save herself, where I would imagine anyone else, maybe Erica is not cutting her by that point, but she certainly would have been in hot water had either member of Chilltown won it. And then it all comes down to, essentially, can Janelle run the table? And she does a really good job in both of her first 2 seasons, as you said, of coming very close. But this is why we talk about this not being a viable strategy. Even when you can win 90% of the rounds, you win a competition, you're going to get taken out as soon as you're vulnerable. And this is what we talk about with the Aussies on Survivor, the Joey Amazing on Survivor. And I think Janelle might be the ultimate example of that on Big Brother. And I think it's frankly, it misleads people into thinking that this is such a good idea because they see the Donatos win all these competitions and go on to win a season that they would never win if it wasn't overtly rigged in their favor. They see Rachel Riley talk about floaters needing to get a life vest and how competitions are the most critical part of a competition, of a final, a final resume for when you're facing the jury, and they see her win and it gets reinforced. And I think it all started with Janelle.
And that point about competitions on your resume, I think has been conclusively disproven now by Paul, who, did he equal Janelle's record? Did he improve upon it? Either way, he is. Go ahead.
Yeah, he did. He set a new individual record for competitions won, and also set the new record for days played in only 2 seasons when Janelle and Boogie both played 3. Granted, they were shorter
right.
seasons.
And yeah, I don't think anyone is going to remember Paul as oh, that guy was an absolute competition beast, mm-hmm. right? And in fairness, part of that was convincing other people to throw them to him, which I'm still not sure how he was able to do that. But regardless, like, he won, and it doesn't matter how you win. A win is still a win. And, I think he will go down as many things, but not as this Janelle-tier competition player. And so maybe that reveals something about Janelle, that she's only remembered as such because all the other aspects of her game are so lacking that that's really the only thing you can say on her behalf.
Well, I think it's also just because she was such a popular figure on a season that was split so down the middle in the first place, and then, frankly, split down the middle again on the early weeks of BB7, where it was really season 6 against everyone. She, as we've talked about, we talked about this in great detail when we were covering BB14 in real time, Janelle might be the most polarizing figure we've ever talked about on reality TV as far as making the game come down to you are with me or you're against me, and also making the audience come down to you're with me or you're against me.
Yeah, she doesn't quite frame it in Rachel Riley terms of floaters get a life vest, stuff like that. She's not as overtly aggressive about it, but the vibe that she gives off is certainly, well, you're either in the cool kids club with me or you're not, and if you're not, I'm going to make no effort to even give you the time of day or make you think that you have anything to offer me, or right. vice versa.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sure, as Dom mentioned, we're going to dive even deeper into Janelle next week, but let's go back onto this spider web. Let's get through these next few people who dropped early and what eggs they got. James was the next one down. He got the egg that lets him nullify an eviction vote this week. And hilariously, you know, by the end of this week, he is completely turned on Janelle and is hysterical in nullifying Janelle's vote. Mike Boogie, never run bad, gets the $10,000 as he's wearing a t-shirt that says "I'm rich, bitch" and a bandana with cash on it. Kacer, of course, gets the rotten egg because it's his birthday week and nothing can go right for Kacer this week. And then everyone says Chicken George, of course, the last one left is the slot pass. Go down and get it. George says, no, I'm going to hang on. Marcellus ends up being the one who gets the slot pass and later gives it to George, as they had all agreed to do. But I'm going to give a hot take here, Dom. I think it was almost selfish of George to not jump down for the slot pass at that point, when just because he knows everyone's going to give it to him. It's almost like he's taking the free roll at winning the challenge. I don't think he was thinking about it in yeah. those terms at all. But I think in practice, that is going to be viewed as like a selfish move to not just drop and take it.
Yeah, I'm sure this was meant to be a touching moment, that Marcellus, in this moment of selflessness, give George a slot pass and they're able to bond, and it's so heartwarming. But I'm just frustrated with George. Like, of course you take the slot pass. Like, you did this to yourself, right? You put yourself in this situation. And now, as you say, I don't think he was explicitly expecting people to win it and then give it to him. There's no, like, power game going on there. But it's still just like, dude, just take the slot pass, okay?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Clearly this is traumatic for you, even, you know, how many days later is this, like 10 days later? By the end of 60 days of this, you are going to be a complete and utter wreck if you weren't already. So just do it. Like, there's no reason to put yourself through all of that.
I totally agree. And I think you're right that, like, it was an attempt at, like, this touching scene, but you could certainly tell Marcellus was open about, like, I did not want to give Chicken George that slot pass. Like, I wanted that slot pass for myself. I think he did just feel guilted into doing this. And this is, like, I'm guessing Marcellus ultimately, while he did, like, he gave it to him because he said he felt bad for Chicken George, who just looked so pathetic while everyone else was enjoying the pizza party. I'm guessing Marcellus was, at the end of the day, not happy that he ended up, like, mad at Chicken George for almost forcing him to give up that slot pass that could have been his, when George just as easily could have dropped and gotten the slot pass for himself, when he's never going to win this competition.
I'm sure he was, but I think he was also glad that he was able to make, like, this performative gesture of kindness to someone else and be recognized as this selfless saint.
I think Marcellus does probably like any opportunity he gets to feel selfless. Like, I think he would admit that himself. And I'm the same way. Like, if I get an opportunity to be a really good guy, I feel great about it. One thing I wanted to add, though, I mentioned Mike Boogie got the $10,000. I know this season of BB19, they did actually start throwing in more money incentives, but I think initially that was just to make sure Paul got into the house. Of course, no, the whole house is not going to turn down that $25,000. I really wish they would start adding in more money incentives, though, to mix things up, especially now that we're seeing these modern players so often form these groups and know exactly what to do in every competition and throw everything to each other and make sure the right person or wrong person doesn't win any given week, and then it's all just kind of set in stone from there. I really would love it if they would throw in more just cash prizes, and in particular, I don't know why they ever stopped doing this, but what they did in BB10, those gold bars, like $10,000 in $1,000 increments in those gold bars that they could give to each other and use to, like, barter with other players. I wish those were, like, almost like garnets that we see on The Genius, that they would throw in a couple every round on Big Brother to try to get just more people with more actual leverage for deal making. I think that would add a whole different element to the game that I think it desperately needs right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we get down to the end game of this spider web now. We only have Howie, Danielle, and Erica left up here. All of season six hopes lie with Howie, which is not a good place to be. He ends up dropping out in third here. We quickly see Erica drop to give Danielle the new HOH. Erica, by the way, someone who understands what we were just talking about, Janelle not understanding. Erica sees, okay, Danielle's obviously not coming after me. I can't get off this spider web fast enough. I don't want to give her an opportunity to pin me with this HOH.
Well, it's also revealing, I think, that Erica feels comfortable enough with Danielle that she is willing to drop out so quickly, because we see the friendship between the two of them collapse in such dramatic terms later on in the season. But it's never really made explicit how or why they were so close or when that became the case. So I'm guessing that in those initial few weeks when it was season six running the house and no one else could even get their foot in the door, there was some bonding going on between the floaters as they saw them that we didn't even really get to see because it just wasn't important to the storyline of season six versus the world. But those relationships end up being absolutely crucial later, as and I think Danielle and Erica is the perfect example of that.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right that it's certainly possible that as it's season six against Chilltown, against the world, especially if you think through that floater kind of group, I think Danielle and Erica would be a logical combination to come together. Like, who else is Danielle going to be talking to if she wants to keep it on the DL that she's kind of with James and Chilltown? Like Chicken George, Marcellus?
Right, yeah, those are literally the only two options, right?
Right.
I guess like Diane before she left, but yeah, it's... If you're thinking about this third axis that is going to develop here in the middle, it really can only be Danielle and Erica, and it's a pretty natural pairing, I think.
Yeah, and speaking of natural pairings, we finally get to see on TV a little bit more about the Legion of Doom, and I call this a natural pairing because it doesn't even seem like this is presented from any perspective. Now, like, rewatching this now for the millionth time, it really stands out that... They're almost overt about this being an alliance that started before the game even began. Like, they just kind of they present it as, oh, this is the Legion of Doom finally getting a chance to make our first statement, when it seems like we haven't even really heard anything about them to this point on the TV show.
Yeah, the show tries to make it look like the catalyst for this was James gets alienated by things that Janelle is doing. He goes to Danielle, she goes to Chilltown, and that's what sets this chain of events in motion. I think in reality, the groundwork for this was laid long before any of them even set foot inside the house. And in fairness to James, he did have side alliances with literally everyone. But I think as he got inside the house and some of those were winnowed away, like some of those people got evicted, others showed that they couldn't really be stable long-term allies, the best option left on the table for him just became Danielle and Chilltown, so the Legion of Doom. And it has a nice side effect of getting the two most threatening players in Danielle and then Chilltown as a unit on your side, and you would much rather have them inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in, as the saying goes.
Right, especially when you know that season six is certainly going to be on the hot seat as soon as they don't win power for a given week. And actually, to quickly go back to that, I don't feel like I was hyperbolic enough about just how big of a deal it was for me just watching in real time and having someone other than season six win an HOH here. I remember vividly being at home watching this episode as it aired. I wasn't a live feed watcher back then. I was like unspoiled on how it was going to go, sweating so hard, almost as hard as Howie was up on that spider web, wondering if he was going to win or if, because I was such a huge, and still am, by the way, a big Danielle Reyes fan, that I was really thrilled to see her end up taking that as well, to really see, to feel like there was a formidable opponent in there finally ready to take on season six. I think it was a huge deal for the momentum of the season. I don't know if I could have handled in real time yet another week of season six winning. Because I think about watching these seasons when we go into HOH competitions, every single week we're rooting for the messy outcome. We're rooting for the, like, Kevin HOH or whatever, to use an example from BB19, where in the beginning of BB7, we just weren't getting anything close to that.
Yeah, this was a really pivotal moment for anyone who wasn't a season six fan, just in terms of giving them hope that the season could turn out differently. And I think there is a timeline that season six just wins like 9 HOHs straight and still implodes on each other over the course of that, because either James is going off doing his own thing, or Will is able to get inside Janelle's ear and turn her against James, or whatever. Like, there are ways you can imagine that's all going to come crashing down. But at the same time, I think this period of dominance for season six was just long enough that it made people want something else, and then that something else came in basically the best way possible for them.
Right, exactly. I'm wondering how you would rank, entering the season with this cast, how would you rank the four members of season six winning chances overall? Not how, seeing how things went, how would you have power ranked the season sixers in terms of most to least likely to win?
So I think I would have said, It seems so weird, given that we've seen James's downfall in both seasons, to put James at the top of that list. But, like, are you going to put Kaysa there instead? Are you going to put Janelle? Like, you're certainly not going to put Howie.
This is my question. This is what I was getting at.
Okay.
It really seems like in All-Star seasons, if there's a person there who, and Howie is not, frankly, probably not going to be this person, but the person who is the last one in, basically, like Howie got in through the America's vote, but was not really deemed, I would imagine, a big strategic powerhouse. The person who is in the All-Star season, but not viewed at all as a real player within the game, is, I would say, the most dangerous place to be. And the problem is that person is Howie, who is just going to stick his head up Janelle's ass and just do whatever she says and make a big scene out of himself everywhere he goes.
So typically that person is someone who is able to keep a fairly low profile, isn't drawing attention to themselves, isn't alienating other house guests, and I don't know that Harry is able to conform to that. I do agree, though, that that is the model that we see for winners of All-Star seasons. However, I would say it's actually confirmed in fantastic detail by this season, where I think coming in, the two people who were not on anyone's radar as far as All-Star candidates are concerned are Mike Boogie and Erica, and they're the two finalists, with Boogie able to win in a season which, you know, like we see Kesa, who's his massive fan favorite, doesn't even make the jury again. Like Danielle, who I think was the most threatening non-winner, so like removing Will from the equation in the entire cast, and that she just gets completely embarrassed by Will, right? And you can say that, okay, Will was the perfect shield for Boogie, but at the same time, that's part of why people say this in the first place, right? Is if you're able to team up with someone who plays your game but plays it better than you do, if that person gets taken down, you're able to inherit that mantle and just ride it forward.
Yeah. No, I think that's definitely right. Although, to go back to the initial question, I would probably put, just given who Howie is, I think I would agree that I would have James at number one. I don't think I could be talked into having Howie below either of Janelle or Kaser. I think Howie backs into way more wins than Janelle or Kaser gets organically.
So I don't know if this is even a hot take or not, and I don't think it can be, given how so many people are still absolutely in love with Kaysa and insist to this day that he's some fantastic mastermind or whatever. But I think Kaysa actually is kind of an underrated player and got a bit of a raw deal with the way that his two seasons were structured. So in BB6, it was very much, okay, you have the house is split down the middle. There are two clearly defined sides. And at that point, it doesn't really matter if you're a friendship member, let's say, you probably like Kaysa more than you like some of the other people there, certainly more than you like Janelle, maybe Harry, maybe some others. But your loyalty to your side is so overwhelming that you're going to listen to what Maggie's telling you to do. You're going to listen to what your alliance wants. And what's best for your alliance clearly is Kaysa going out, because he's the leader of that side. Right. So there's no chance for him to form these bonds across the aisle, if you like. And work as his advantage. And then coming into BB7, he once again is with the same group that he was with before, and it becomes BB6 versus the world, and there's no real subtlety there. And for as much as James is able to get a parachute, Janelle has a thing going on with Marcellus on the side, like Kaysa wasn't able to get that, but that's because I think, again, everyone realized that he was the spiritual leader of season six,
right?
And so you didn't really want to become too closely anchored to him. And so, like, we saw Danielle form this very intense personal bond with Kaysa, and she's the type to put business before pleasure, right? She knows that if Kaysa needs to go, then Kaysa needs to go, regardless of how I feel about it. But I think a better example might be Erica, who almost falls in love with Kaysa inside the house, but where does that really get Kaysa? Like, at the end of the day, Erica is on the other side, and so if it comes down to season six versus the other side, she has to go with the other side.
Right. I would really Marcellus too seemed to be in love with Kaysa once he isn't, so I would do anything for Kaysa, but he still isn't.
Yeah. This is what I'm saying. I think the guy actually is an excellent social player, but the way that both of his seasons are played out, that wasn't as relevant as it might be within a more fluid game of Big Brother.
Okay, and I would argue, I agree, first of all, that he is an excellent social player, and I would probably say an underrated strategic player. Like, I'm sure he would do well at understanding the theory behind a lot of just Big Brother tactics, but it does seem to me like when he's actually in there playing Big Brother, he puts himself in the position where he is the figurehead of his alliance. And I guess, are you saying that that's only a product of the way these seasons played out, where first his house was split and then it was an All-Star season where, you know, a third of the house was his alliance from the previous season? So what are you going to do? Because maybe I there may be something to that, that maybe if Kaysa was in a dynamic where he could hang back a little bit, I think he could have more staying power. But I do just frankly feel like Kaysa Razor presents himself as such a capable and threatening Big Brother player that he's going to have a really hard time making it to the end of the game in a winnable position where he's going to get, barring in like a Derek Levasseur situation or whatever, where he just finds himself surrounded by people willing to do whatever he wants. I think as soon as Kacer, the opposition to Kacer's alliance gets power, Kacer is going to be very near the top of the hit list, perhaps only below Janelle, who I think might actually have had the lowest equity out of all of season six to win this season. I feel like she frankly can only really win when she runs the table, and both of her seasons, or you know, BB6 and BB7, she came one round away from doing that, but there were probably five or six other rounds where she would have left if she didn't win a power, and she just happened to win that week to prolong the stay. So I think it's an interesting conversation, though, just the general BB6 expectations for these four when they're not playing under such weird circumstances. All right. So let's, I guess, get into how these nominations are going to go. And while Danielle does have this Legion of Doom bond going with Chilltown and James, it seems like one of the things she's really considering is putting James up there next to Janelle. I guess let's first of all start with, is there any way you're leaving Janelle off the block here?
No, I think any attempt to kind of backdoor her, it's tempting because you know how good she is in challenges, but I think it ends up just being too tricksy. Like, everyone knows that Janelle is the target for this week, and if it's not her, it's going to be Kacer. If it's not Kacer, it's going to be someone else. So I think you just put the two biggest targets up there and let them at it. Now, the question is, do you want that second target to be Kacer? Or, because I think for a lot of people outside their alliance, the natural move would be, okay, James is the veto king, right? He is the next best person in competitions other than Janelle. He may even be better than Janelle, and he just didn't last long enough to show it. So if you're thinking purely on that level, then you're going to put the two of them up. However, everyone knows that Danielle and James have this friendship, alliance, however far it goes in their mind. And I think Danielle was so keen to put that perception to rest because she knows that she's going to rely on it later on, that she puts up James knowing that whether he's up against Janelle or up against Kacer, that other person is always going to go instead.
Right, right. And I think she actually did a great – I think they both pulled off an incredible acting job in making this work where we see the fallout to these nominations when James does end up going up on the block. They show on TV, and I'm sure there were many, many conversations that didn't make air, many people reacting saying, oh my God, I can't believe Danielle put you up. I thought you guys were best friends in here. Both James and Danielle, I think, had a really tough role to play as in trying to make this nomination seem legitimate. And as far as I can tell, they did a really good job. At least we got confessionals from Marcellus and Janelle, and maybe that's just selective confessional insertion there. But it seemed like they totally went from thinking that, correctly thinking, by the way, that James and Danielle were tight to thinking, oh my God, I guess that was something that was completely unfounded. Like Marcellus says to Danielle in the HOH room, oh my God, there was this myth in the cosmos that you had a deal with James coming in, and I guess that's completely blown up, when in fact that was completely the reality of it.
Yeah, although, so by the end of that week, even Janelle is floating the idea to James that, are you sure that Danielle wasn't, you know, plotting something the whole time? I think if even Janelle as the target for that ruse is able to see through it, then maybe it's not so convincing. And for as much as James likes to sell himself as this fantastic actor, I think to the extent that that worked, it's more because of Danielle's reputation coming in as someone who is willing to put the game above friendship. So for Marcellus, when you thought that you were super tight with Danielle in season three, and then she just completely tears your heart out, it's very easy to think that, you know, okay, she might be friends with James, but that doesn't actually count for anything within the game of Big Brother. And that's the definitely the reputation that she's playing off here.
Yeah, I think the only other person outside of season six who probably felt even remotely threatened this week might have been Marcellus, just based on how he knew Danielle probably thought he felt about her. If I phrase that correctly, like the level two perception.
They see what you mean.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also just given that he was somewhat tight, apparently with season six early on, I could see him sweating out this Danielle Reyes HOH. We actually see him before the nominations be very quick to go and throw Janelle under the bus to Danielle.
Yeah, because this is in that middle period of the season when the repercussions of Janelle going after Diane for reasons which are still not entirely clear to him or to anyone else. That's, you know, this is one of the consequences of that, is that really turns Marcellus away. And to the extent that when Janelle then wins HOH, she is able to be tricked into putting him up and evading him, or at least putting him up and presiding over his eviction, because he is so vocal about his resentment over that still. Now, so I think there's this idea in that Danielle is trying to kind of put out there that James is her Jason, right? Mm-hmm. And James and Jason, personality-wise, are two very different people, two very different players.
Both virgins, also, based on what I've heard. Neither have ever had sex with anyone. So
that's exactly what I was going for, yeah. So I think the obvious difference, the most obvious one of many, is that in season three, they were able to keep that completely under wraps, and no one had any idea until the end that Daniel and Jason actually were working so closely together, whereas everyone knew from day one in Big Brother All-Stars that Daniel and James had a thing going on, and James is not really one for subtlety, despite what he might, you know, try to pretend otherwise. And so how does that change how you have to handle that relationship? Do you have to go to such extremes to try and cover that up, or do you just act on the assumption that, well, everyone kind of knows already, and we may as well just not even insult their intelligence by trying to disguise it like this?
So I generally, in games like Big Brother or on Survivor, I'm almost always an advocate for respect people and their intelligence, and don't try to get anything over on them that they're not going to believe. And I would have said trying to put up James and sell it like you're actually targeting him is too much for me. Like, the house isn't going to buy it, and it's just going to make you look worse. But this is the reason I wanted to bring it up and give them such credit for doing a good job here, because it really does seem to me like they take this angle out of feeling like that the perception is too high. People are too worried about them being a pair, and they need to do something about that. And what better opportunity than for Danielle to put James up on the block and make it look like she's genuinely rooting for, if not him, someone from his alliance to be leaving, and she would be fine with him if it ends up being that way. I think it frankly did a great job. I think this could have been crucial in protecting the Legion of Doom for the next couple of weeks, is this nomination of James, which I never really had considered prior to this rewatch of the season.
How much credit are you giving Danielle versus James there? Because it seems to me it's a lot more about Danielle playing on that perception of her than James putting on this incredible acting job.
I think it's both. I think it's a good idea that requires, I think, very high level execution to actually be pulled off successfully. So I give a lot of credit to both of them for that.
I guess, but who are you actually trying to convince? Because the people outside of season six, you have Chilltown, who are in your Legion of Doom, and so if Chilltown ever decides to deviate from that, if they decide this isn't the best plan for them anymore, they can very easily blow up your spot and just say that, you know, Danielle and James both knew what the deal was the whole time. And then you have Marcellus, who I guess buys into it, at least at first, so job well done there. Chicken George, who is going to believe whatever you tell him to believe. Erica, who I think was tight enough with both James and Danielle that it's maybe that makes it easier to convince her. I'm not quite sure. And then the other people are just season six members who, like, I question how useful this really is, because let's say Janelle wins HOH. Like, she survives somehow, Casey goes home, she wins HOH, which is exactly what happens. And now her first instinct is going to be, I'm going to put up Danielle and try and get my revenge. And so if you're James, are you going to try and talk her out of that? Do you try and ease off on the pedal there so that she doesn't think you're tight still? Like, how do you actually handle that going ahead?
It sounded to me like she wanted it to be James being her man on the inside for season six, so they could have an ear on what Kacer and Janelle and Howie were thinking. But so I think that would be probably the primary consideration. But frankly, in nominating James, it would come down to me between two different decisions. As we've talked about, Janelle is going up. It's either going to be against James or against Kacer. And it sounds to me, we get a scene of Danielle privately talking to Kacer in the HOH saying, you're the only person I trust in here. It seems like she had a good enough relationship with Kacer that the value of disguising your relationship with James plus keeping Kacer safe in the event that no one ends up using that veto this week, I think not nominating James when you know that that you and him can both effectively sell this nomination would be actually a big mistake.
Okay.
I just think it can't hurt. Why not put up someone to disguise the alliance if you can sell it and if it keeps you on better terms with Kacer?
I guess the argument could be that assuming one of Janelle or Kacer wins HOH if you put them up, which is not an outrageous assumption to make, you would have to put James up anyway, I think, if there's going to be any pretense whatsoever. Right. So why not do that now and try and really capitalize on that, knowing that James probably is not going to be in danger regardless.
Right, and not only that, you're keeping Kacer out of being able to win a veto for himself while giving James the opportunity to come off the block completely organically. Like, you're like, well, James came off the block, and what nothing I can do about it, when secretly it was a ruse the whole time.
And also, it did seem like, as I was saying, Danielle and Kacer did have this pretty good bond going, and so if she keeps him off, and then she never has to put him up because, let's say, I don't know, Boogie wins veto, keeps the nominations the same, Janelle goes home, then she can really sell to Kacer that, like, I didn't want to put you up because of that connection that I have with you. And so maybe if Kacer wins HOH again, or if Janelle wins and Kacer is in her ear, that's going to really work out well in her favor.
Right. Going forward, not only does she have to, if she's worried about season six retribution, by leaving Kacer on the block, potentially she only has to worry about Janelle and Howie winning HOH the following week compared to Janelle, Howie, or Kacer. Although I guess in her mind, one of them would be gone for sure this week. But regardless, let's get into this power of veto here, Dom. And before we do, this is the graveyard veto. At the risk of being hyperbolic, I will say this is one of the greatest veto competitions of all time. This might be my single favorite veto competition in the history of Big Brother.
Yeah, there is no risk of being hyperbolic here. This is, I will allow you to praise it in as effusive terms as you want. This is absolutely incredible.
Okay, with the exception of the genius, this is the greatest 12-minute segment.
Okay.
This is the greatest 12 minutes in the history of American reality TV.
Or just in the history of television as a medium, if you want to go to that level. But so let's start with a negative, as we always do. So there was some speculation that in the week where it seemed like Janelle was going to be legitimately in danger for the first time, it's awfully convenient that the veto competition is something which you can win just by wanting it more effectively and being willing to sacrifice things for it. And also that the way the points are calculated is in this very opaque way where you don't get to see, okay, this person hit their buzzer first, so they did this, right? It's all, you're in this individual container where no one can see you, and you've got your own buzzer and you're pressing it. So if they wanted to make it look like, oh, well, Janelle just wanted it more and she was willing to make all of these sacrifices and, you know, that's why she won veto, that's the storyline they could have sold. So does that hold any water for you, or is that kind of Helen is pushed level conspiracy theory?
I mean, it's not the craziest conspiracy theory to me, especially when in week three for any major disruption, it was also another kind of who wants it more when we knew Chicken George would cut off his foot if it meant he got to stay in the house. Actually, as someone, shout out to Stacy. She framed it to me the other day because she was just watching this season to like follow along with our podcast. She's someone I know from poker, the main poker scene, another Big Brother, huge fan of the main poker scene. She said, it seriously seemed like Chicken George would have eaten shit if you had told him to. Like, he literally would have done that to stay in the house.
If this was Grodner era Big Brother, there would have been some kind of like official censure against whatever they would have made Chicken George do to get that veto, because they really would have taken it to the extreme.
Yeah. Where was I going with that? Sorry. The Janelle and the timing of the competition. Yes, there is certainly something to that. But I would argue that there's also going to be whoever is in the position of they need it more, they want it more. There is almost always going to be someone on the opposition saying, I got to prevent them from getting it. And in this case, we get Danielle in there trying to do exactly what Janelle is doing and get all of the negative ones that are going to accrue points. The way the competition works is everyone starts with 40 points. There are going to be 10 offers, and it can accept a punishment and gain points, and your point total will go up. And whoever has the most points, whoever's taken the most point value worth of punishment at the end of the competition is our veto winner. And similarly, you can spend your points on fabulous prizes, which we will get to later. But I would say the negative for me about this competition, not just the timing for like Janelle's convenience, is it essentially it seems to me like it's going to just come down to which of Janelle or Danielle is faster on the buzzer, because they're both going to just be buzzing in for every single negative one.
Well, by Danielle, I think you mean the Legion of Doom, which is obviously going to work as a cohesive unit. They're going to make these personal sacrifices to ensure that the group's goal is met for that week, and Janelle's not going to win the veto.
Danielle has a hysterical quote in the diary room right before that goes into this competition, where she says, I'm willing to give up anything and everything to make sure nominations stay the same, and I expect the same from my alliance.
Well, as Danielle told us last week, she thinks that Boogie is not that type of band to break his word. And so, yeah, basing it on that philosophy, maybe it makes sense. But I don't know if this is Danielle just like going soft since Big Brother 3, or if she's losing her touch, or if she was already so like infatuated with Chilltown that she was willing to put this very... this very rose-tinted view on things. But how can you believe that? Like, it seems like this runs counter to everything that you should know about Will and Boogie as a pair, and everything that makes them so endearing, almost.
Right. Let's hear what Mike Boogie had to say about how hard he was going to try for this veto once he saw what it was.
I told Danielle that I would do whatever to try to win the veto. I, however, at the time I made this promise, did not exactly know there were going to be fabulous prizes like plasma televisions.
So there you have it. That's going to be the kind of wavelength that Chilltown is on for this, where they are going to be snatching up as many prizes as they can, especially because it's important to note, I don't think we pointed out yet, for the people who haven't rewatched this lately, no one will ever find out who got what items. They will just see that an offer was accepted, and they will find out who wins the veto, but it will never be revealed who ended up doing what to as far as punishments for the house, or who ended up taking what as far as prizes.
And Chilltown is able to keep a lid on this for the rest of the game, as far as I'm aware. So Danielle left the house truly believing that it wasn't Chilltown who lost that competition for them. Right. And so I wonder at what point in the jury house she learned, like everyone else compared notes and realized that, hold on, so if I took this and you took this, then that meant, oh, come on. Right. And I wonder what she was feeling in that moment, because we see the montage of the finale where I think at that point she already knew and was already kind of over it and was able to take it in good spirits. But I'm sure when she learned it, like that really must have been just heartbreaking for her.
Right. Because they did do a really good job of pinning all of the prizes that they took on Marcellus and making Marcellus look like the greedy one who was in there without a care in the world about the veto. Like, Will was claiming at the end of the competition with a straight face that he didn't get anything, that he finished the competition with the same 40 points that he started with.
And I love that they're able to pin it on Marcellus as well, because not only is he, like, there's this grudge developing between Marcellus and Chilltown that, like, they never actually get to add on it, because Marcellus doesn't win any form of power. He doesn't have any influence in the house. And then Chilltown, for the time being, has much bigger fish to fry than Marcellus. So it's always like this cold war going on, where it's this passive aggressive, like back and forth, where no one can even do anything. This is the first time that either of them really gets to vent their anger, and Chilltown does it in such brilliant fashion. But also, Marcellus is such a perfect target for it, too, because he is always leaning into this persona that he's made for himself about how he's like this hyper materialistic kind of person, and then they're able to pay, like, okay, well, maybe he's the guy who won a trip to Aruba and $5,000 and a plasma TV. Like, he's exactly the sort of guy who might take those sort of things, don't you think? And everyone's just nodding along in agreement.
Right, exactly. Like, Chilltown runs good yet again, that it's Marcellus in there as the dummy person that they can pin it on, instead of like Kaser or like Chicken George or Howie, who's like never taking any of this stuff.
If they tried to pin it on Kaser, I don't think even someone as convincing as Will would be able to pull that off. But Marcellus almost makes it too easy for them. It's like right. Anyone could have done that.
Marcellus is the very clear number one draft pick in the house to be there to pin it on. So let's get into what each of these offers are going to be. And the way this works, actually, since we need a host, but the host isn't allowed to see any of these bids. Erica is hosting this in front of the rest of the group in the couches inside. It's actually very cool. She's talking into a microphone going out over the loudspeakers, and more on that group of people later, because they're going to be some of the people who get punished here pretty brutally, despite not even being in the competition. But let's go through these offers. The first one is that everyone's bed in the house is going to be replaced with an army cot, and there will be no hot water, which now I think is like standard. That'd be like an upgrade for a have not on any given week of modern Big Brother.
Yeah, nowadays you count yourself lucky if you don't have to sleep on actual spikes. So this is luxury by comparison.
Yeah, Janelle ends up getting this one. Following that, we have 24 hours of solitary confinement worth 9 points. Danielle takes this one, and it's pretty brutal here where she just hangs out in the storage room by herself for 24 hours. I remember Hayden had to do this at some point during BB12. Were there other times that they've done the 24-hour solitary confinement? Because I really like this.
Well,
as a punishment.
That's Dan, I think, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Dan's funeral came out of 24 hours. Yeah, see, this is what I was saying is, I love the 24-hour solitary confinement. This is a great BB punishment. I just think they don't do it because it's not TV-friendly for the most part, even though you get stuff like Dan's funeral that comes out of it.
Yeah, unless it's someone like Hayden who seems completely and utterly unflappable, this solitary confinement punishment is guaranteed to make someone snap, and sometimes that leads to incredible things for them, as we see with Dan's funeral, or it leads to incredible things for the viewers when someone just goes insane. And I think the payoff there was delayed because, you know, Danielle doesn't actually go up and out for another month or so, but I wonder if this was maybe the thing that ultimately led to that, where it's like she goes through this experience where it just shatters your psychological integrity, and then the only people there to try and piece that back together are Chilltown. And so when they eventually decide to turn on Danielle, they know the perfect way to just get inside her head and make her break down, and that's what we end up seeing.
Well, I feel like they make up for it the following week when Danielle gets nominated by Janelle next week, and they do kind of the same veto goofball gambit with her, where we're going to have the competition where all of the former house guests come back and compete against them in the round-by-round style, and Chilltown put on this elaborate ruse to throw Danielle the veto that she desperately needs. So I think that is an effective way to mend that kind of fence.
Yeah, maybe this is just a conjecture on my part, but to me, this is what really cemented that in that alliance, Chilltown has all the cards, as if there was any doubt. And there would be some doubt coming in, because I think if you looked at this cast and you thought, who is going to be the most effective opposition to Chilltown if it comes down to that? I think it would be Danielle, like the consensus best player to never win, someone who Will mentioned as having a great deal of respect for as a player and as an opponent in the game. But this really highlighted how, like, when it ultimately came down to it, Chilltown was able to keep themselves composed and focused on their own goals, whereas Danielle was just distracted by these other concerns.
Right, and I think it was a crucial priority by Chilltown, as I mentioned, to go on and right this wrong with Danielle, because as you mentioned, I agree, she's probably the most formidable opponent if someone was going to be taking down Chilltown later on in the season. And I wonder if they hadn't gone so far to make her feel a lot better the following week, I would really question the wisdom of blatantly burning Danielle so hard, so early, when she's such a dangerous player. But it really does seem like they did a solid job recovering from that.
Yeah, it's yet another one of those moves which, if it was anyone other than Chilltown and someone who wasn't able to execute it so effectively, we'd be saying, that is such a massive risk, it's such an unnecessary risk, keep your eye on the prize, like the actual prize, not like some trip to Aruba or something like that. Just, you know, keep your focus, don't get distracted, don't make this terrible blunder. But somehow, because it always seems to work out for them, it's hard to really describe it as a blunder at all, right? It's, and maybe it's the ultimate form of being results-oriented, but I feel like you kind of have to trust them to some degree.
Well, I would compare it almost to, I remember as we were watching BB15, I think we gave up on podcasting about BB15 a little over halfway through, but we were watching BB15. I remember when Andy won his HOH, I think at Final 9, and then also when he tried to lie about his vote during the live double eviction, I remember thinking to myself, oh man, Andy, you're finally going to get caught. Like, you've been doing such a good job. This is what's going to get you in trouble. And when you can pull that off, it's not, this is what's going to get you in trouble. It's, these are the little things that are going to make a huge difference later on. And you are a grandmaster player and can pull them off.
Yeah, but as it turns out, Chilltown make out like bandits. And let's get the official rundown in their words of what they were able to pick up here.
Hey, Boogie, did you win POV today?
Nah. I won a trip to Aruba for two and a plasma television. Did you win POV?
No, I won $5,000.
So that's what Chilltown had to say about the competition overall. Clearly heartbroken that they weren't able to get that veto, but what are you going to do? I feel like now would be the time to play what I'm going to call, while we're in the hyperbole zone, my favorite confessional in the history of Big Brother. Here's Will talking about his decision to take specifically the $5,000.
Listen, money can't buy you love, but money can buy you stuff, and I love stuff!
So there you go. And I really do think, like, it's incredible how Will gets away with behaving in this manner and just being so overtly selfish and I guess, like, greedy. There's no other word for it in this context. Like, he's foregoing helping his alliance for his own personal gain outside the game. But it really, I think, serves to draw people in towards him in a spot where I think most people, the viewers in particular, would think less of them. Will always does things in such a charming way that he manages to get away with it. And this is, I think, a perfect example of that, where he and Boogie gobble up all of the prizes, and one of America's favorite players of all time, Daniel Reyes, is left furious at him, but everyone, it seems, in the viewing audience is on Will's side.
I think Will's entire body of work across two seasons really proved all of those seemingly bullshit adages, if that's how you say it, that people have about confidence, where it's like, so if you try something and you kind of commit to it, but you're hesitant, you're kind of unsure, it's not going to work. People aren't going to be convinced, and you're going to look worse because of it. But if you do everything like an 18 out of 10, then things which normally would seem just completely outrageous suddenly become like normalized, and they expect it from you and they like it from you, and that becomes part of your appeal. And I feel like that's so true with Will, where like anyone else who tries doing what he does, and we've seen a lot of wannabe Will imitators over the years, so many of them come in and it's like they try to just play from his playbook, and they don't really do it that well, or they don't commit to it that fully, and people just think, this guy's really shifty, I don't trust him, we don't want to work with him. But somehow for Will, he just doubles down, triples down, quadruples down, and it always works, and he never gets punished for any of that. And it's borderline frustrating to think that, like, if only you could suddenly flip a switch and have the personality that Will has, like, life would probably be a lot easier. But equally, it's obviously fantastic to watch as well. So as a fan, you know, that's the main way you look at it.
Right. And I think what separates Will from this, from like the other people that we see try to go in there and do this, like, to me, the difference between Will and like a Zach Rantz or like Paul on these last couple of seasons is, it feels to me like those guys are playing characters, whereas Will feels like he's just being Will, and he gets away with being such a smarmy dipshit all the time because he never turns it off, because that's just how he is. Like, I think he doesn't put any kind of pretense on it, and what he says to people just comes across as his honest reaction in the moment, even if it is something totally calculated.
And think about how many times we've heard the criticism of these players who seemingly were in control of, well, they're not really owning their game, I don't know how much they were responsible for, they're trying to like butter me up on the way out, but I can see right through it, and it makes me think less of them. You're never going to have that with Will. The idea of Will not owning his own game seems so completely foreign that like it really illustrates just how effective he is, because like he tells you, I'm going to stab you in the front, and then he does it, and you don't care, you like him, so it
right.
is. Yeah.
Right. I mean, he overtly, he says, I want every member of the jury to be in there thinking, what cost me the game Chilltown? What, just straight down the line. He loved having Marcellus and then Howie and then whoever, you know, James and whoever's going in. He liked that every single one of them felt betrayed by Chilltown, and that he wasn't in the position, I think, that we've seen other people, again, to bring up Paul, where he wants everyone to leave feeling like he did their best to keep them. And I think the same thing happened to Dan in BB14, as people were, while they were in the house, feeling so close with both Paul and Dan, whereas Will, it wasn't a surprise at all.
Yeah, and so in the aftermath of BB19, it's like when you watch that clip over and over again of Paul like saying the same thing to each individual juror of, I had nothing to do with your elimination, one of my allies went rogue, you know, I was still in your corner, and hopefully I can win for the both of us, you know, and then they get to the jury house and everyone realizes that they heard the same thing. It's like Will is in this is in the upside down world version of that, where like everyone goes to the jury house and says, okay, so Chilltown, right? Yeah, you. And
right.
Down the line, it's all Chilltown, and they all love them more because of it. The only exception seems to be Marcellus, but I wonder, so, like, we credit Will with being this exceptional, like, social player as well as strategic player, right? I think, to me, the primary difference between someone like Will and someone like Dan is Dan sees the Marcelluses, he sees the Chef Joes, right? The people who just don't like them, who really just viscerally don't like them. And Dan tries to convert those people, right? Dan tries to win them over. Dan tries to, you know, get them on his good side, and often fails at it, but he at least puts the effort in. Whereas Will just doesn't care at all. And it makes you wonder, like, could you construct a cast with 12 Marcelluses in it where Will would just completely fail and his game would never get off the ground because they just wouldn't be open to the idea of working with him, and he wouldn't be open to the idea of trying to adapt his game to work with them?
Totally. I think Will would get absolutely, I think he would be happy to be the first one out in a cast with 12 other Marcelluses. Like, I was wondering earlier, We heard Will during week two, I guess, when Kacer was HOH, he gave the confessional saying, I haven't talked to Kacer in the first 10 days. I don't see a reason to start talking to Kacer now. It wouldn't surprise me at all if through the first 5 or 6 weeks of the game, the entire time that Marcellus is in here, that he just never talks to Chilltown and that they just kind of know, okay, if Marcellus ever does wind up in power, we're screwed.
So what I found really interesting about that is I've alluded to some of these pregame interviews that I was able to unearth. And a lot of these are just quick Q&As in internet chat rooms, such as they were back then in 2006. So it's not really the same like first one out Josh Wiggler style stuff you get nowadays for Survivor. It's a lot more minimalistic and condensed than that. But one of the interesting snippets I found in there was in one of Marcellus's interviews, he's asked about Will and he says, quote, I've met Will many times. He's awesome. So sarcastic, that one. I hope he changes his game this time. So I don't know if that is Marcellus just not wanting to show his cards or just like knowing that Will has something of a following among the online fans and trying to play into that. But I wonder if Marcellus came in not being entirely opposed to the idea of working with Will, but then the reality of actually living with him and watching his game unfold first person just really turned him off to the idea.
Right. I would imagine that Marcellus, as we talked about, like Will just being so dismissive about people who disagree with him, I would say, and just being brutally honest with people that he doesn't seem to respect too much. I would guess it doesn't take a whole, it did not take a whole lot of time for Marcellus to quickly be unmisted by Will if he was ever misted in the first place within that house.
Yeah, I wonder if with Marcellus, so I think Marcellus is arrogant to a degree, but not really in the same way that Will is, but he can't handle someone else wanting to be the center of attention, right? And Will is this consummate performer who every time he has to make things about him, he has to be loud and outrageous, and even in those moments where Will is just doing his thing and working people over, it's always about Will trying to talk to them. It's never like a group forum. It's never, you know, it's Will holding court. And I think Marcellus just doesn't like that. He wants to be that person, right? He wants to be that kind of funny cad that everyone is obsessed with. And there's no, like, Will being in there just deprives him of oxygen, basically. He can never get that.
That's some solid psychoanalysis there, Dr. Harvey. By the way, unmisted or demisted? I actually think I like demisted better. I think that makes more sense.
As in, so they were previously misted, but now that the mist has cleared and they can see clearly now the rain's gone.
Right, they have been demisted. What's the next line? I can't think of the next line. All obstacles in my way or something. What's the next line of that song?
I don't even know.
I can hear the tune. Anyway. Yeah. Let's roll through quickly because we've talked about Chilltown snagging all these prizes. Mike Boogie gets the TV and the trip to Aruba. Will gets $5,000. They pin that all on Marcellus, who only himself actually got this summer-long slot pass. I want to talk, though, about James, because while Danielle and Janelle were, of course, just on a race on the buzzer to see who could get in for all of the punishments, James, who was, mind everyone, on the block here, rang in for the margarita party and the phone call home, and those are the only things he got, and he was open about getting those things as soon as the competition was over. I want to ask you quickly, Dom, about the decision to go for that, especially when the margarita party in particular was so early in the competition that he can't say, oh, I knew I was out of it by that point and I wanted to do something nice for the house. Like, it's very clear when James buzzes in for the margarita party and it's like the third offer that he is not trying for this veto.
Yeah, and James realizes that he has to come up with some kind of rationale for it, but he can't because like the obvious and primary objective for the week is keep the veto in our hands, and just spewing points away on a margarita party doesn't really play into that. So there's really nothing he can say to make it sound better. So you can tell that he's kind of like floundering a bit because there's just nothing he can say that gets him out of the situation.
Right. I really do question the wisdom of that decision, although I suppose once you've already gotten the margarita party and your cover is blown, as he put it, taking that phone call home, which he got, ended up being from Sarah, BB6 callback, his partner, and I assume now wife. I'm guessing they've been happily married for the last 10 years or so. That I haven't kept track, but that's what I'm led to believe based on the TV episodes.
They should do one of those Where Are They Now segments where it's just Sarah watching that clip of James on that Playboy show where they visit his like Vegas crash pad or whatever. Which, yeah, so it's obviously like one thing we don't want to do is just give amateur psychoanalysis of people's relationships, because that's exactly what the worst of the BB fandom is all about. But
are you about to be a Sarah Stan here for a moment and blast James Ryan?
Not as such, but it was weird to kind of like note the contrast between their personalities. And it seems like, you know, thinking back to BB6, Sarah just never really seemed either cut out or really open to the idea of the stuff that we associate with Big Brother. So the lying and the backstabbing and the even just the publicity. Like, she seemed like a fairly kind of introverted person. Whereas James is really not any of those things, and he embraced all of those aspects of the game. And I think, honestly, like he said repeatedly in BB7 that he didn't feel shackled anymore now that he didn't have to look out for Sarah's interests as well, and he could play his own game and not have to balance all of these different concerns. And I think there was something for him of like, well, I can be my own man now, right? Like, this is the one real chance I get, and there's no... And I think James is the type to kind of make excuses in a sense, or to... You know, like, he was always going to say there was this one thing dragging me down, or there was this reason I had to do this. But I think, like, when he didn't have his partner there, for James, that was that changed his Big Brother experience more than anyone else.
Right. I think.
I was going to say, like, Harry having Rachel there, I think he loved that, right? I think, yeah, Janelle with Ashley, like, she was gone first, so it didn't really matter. Kaysa with his partner, like, oh, that didn't go so well, but that was not really the proximate cause of Kaysa's downfall. Whereas for James, I think he came in thinking, okay, now that I don't have Sarah there, I can actually play a lot differently. And we really saw him embrace that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you're right, that James is probably in there in the mentality that it sounds to me like when I hear Eric Stein talk about the prospect of playing Big Brother again, it very much sounds like he would be of the mindset, now I can finally play for the first time. Now I don't have this burden of America and being America's player on my back. And I don't think James would say Sarah was a burden during Big Brother 6, but I think it's that same sentiment of, now I finally get a chance to play a real clean game of Big Brother. So I definitely would agree with that idea. So we have Janelle end up winning this power of veto. And I thought it was interesting that out of these 10 offers, 6 of them were prizes that people gave up points to get, and only 4 were punishments that would gain people points to ultimately win the veto. We saw Janelle get the 7 points for replacing the beds with cots and the no hot water. She also put the rest of the house that was not out there competing on slop for the rest of the week. And then finally, the last question, which was worth 10 points, which also went to Janelle, was skipping the following week's POV. And the only one Danielle even got was the 24 hours of solitary confinement. So Janelle ends up winning this power of veto. And then we get a quick shot of the whole house in the backyard talking about who got what and how many points they all ended up with, etc. And this is where Chilltown lays the groundwork to pin everything on Marcellus with the point total math that they're doing. And it's also where we see that James and Janelle are lying about what they ended up getting. No, I guess James is being honest and is just getting people are mad at him, but Janelle is lying about
it. He has to, yeah. Right?
Right, right.
James has to be honest because there's no lie he can plausibly tell.
Right. But Janelle, critically, does not want people knowing that she got the skip next week's power of veto competition punishment put upon her. She said she'll take it as long as people don't know, but it does seem like people would have to know based on how few punishments there were that whoever won had to have gotten that, and thus it must be Janelle. And I really wonder if the whole house did know. Of course Janelle got the punishment and can't play in next week's power of veto.
That's a very good point too. I thought you were gonna say they would have to know, like, when would they find out? Is it at the point where they do the veto draw, and if Janelle's name comes out, then they just discard that and get another name? Or is it like, if she gets picked, then those are the 6 names, but Janelle can't actually take part? Or like, I wonder when that information actually becomes known to them, because it's very tempting to try to backdoor Janelle, and if she can't even play in the veto competition, then all of those decisions around that become so much easier.
Right. I mean, we'll find out next week when we want to rewatch these episodes, but Janelle wins this HOH, and I think it's at the veto ceremony she says, I'm not eligible to play in the veto. So I think that's when they would have found out.
At the draw, you mean?
Right, at the veto draw ceremony. Yeah, of course. Of course, I shouldn't say of course so dismissively. I very easily could have meant like the veto use ceremony, but then, Dom, the veto would have already been played and people would have known.
Definitely, yeah.
Thank you. I've been very self-conscious. I've noticed it like maybe two or three times, but I'm really trying not to say definitely today.
It's the kind of thing where now I know there's a phenomenon and there's like got a name for this. Like when you're told that something is like popular or something, and then you start noticing it everywhere. So after our discussion about that, I like just saw a tweet from you that just had the word definitely in it, just apropos of nothing. And I was like, okay, right. I need to kind of start keeping a tally of this because on the podcast, it makes sense, right? You're scrabbling around for words and often you just go back to the first thing that comes into your head. At least when you're tweeting, in theory, you can exercise more self-control. So maybe this is a more pathological problem than I've been led to believe.
First of all, anyone who follows me on Twitter and thinks that there is any self-control being exercised is sorely mistaken. I was thinking the other day, I might have the worst account on Twitter. I have such a bad Twitter account. It's embarrassing. But
and yet you have like twice as many followers as me. So what does that say about me?
This is what it says. It says it means you need to tweet more. That is the reason why. It's because I tweet. Hmm. I have twice as many followers as you, and I tweet 10 times as much as you. So it's not really a good balance in my favor.
Yeah, we're creeping up on 5,000 tweets per lifetime over like 7 years. I think by the end of the season, we can just about reach it if we try hard enough.
Yeah, and you're creeping up on like 300 career likes. That's another thing I feel like you could work on in your Twitter.
Dude, I like everything that people send to me, but including the negative stuff, actually. Like, I want to have a record of this, but yeah, I'm sure we can take the social media engagement stuff for another time.
Okay. But well, let's before we dive into just how this round plays out, one point that I just thought is worth noting. I feel like we certainly do a good job of giving Chilltown a tongue bath for the most part on these podcasts. I do want to emphasize something about how all of this ends up going their way. And this is something I would say pretty much every great player who's played a great season has in common, which is Chilltown gets extraordinarily lucky in a ton of different spots over the course of this season. And like the margarita party here is just one instance of it where half the, you know, they win a margarita party for the house, but half the house is on slop. Plus, Danielle is in solitary confinement during this. So it's only like six of them that get to have the margarita party. Of course, Chilltown get to do that. They're never in any punishment costumes. Chilltown just generally does run extremely good over the course of this season, and I think it's always worth acknowledging. And like I said, I don't think that's unique to Chilltown. I think that's something that happens for every kind of dominant game. Like, you have to get breaks, and frankly, a lot of the all-time great players, like, it's preposterous just how good they've run over the course of their seasons.
Yeah, did we ever see Derek in a unitard or anything like that?
You can't even imagine it. Or, like, Dan, for instance, went, I think, all but 1 week of his entire Big Brother career avoiding slop. He was never put on slop except for once. The final time that they did slop, I think, on BB14, everyone said, enough is enough. Like, Dan has to finally, if he's going to play two full seasons of Big Brother, he has to at least try the slop. Or, like, Boston Rob is constantly on tribes that are just stacked with people that are willing to line up and do what they're told. Or like there's a famous genius player that we've noted always draws whatever the best card is in all of the like role assignment games. This person just always gets the best card. It's incredible. And that's just part of being one of the all-time greats. I think like you have to believe in it to have that kind of run good. And you have to earn it, I guess, Dom.
You're officially endorsing the secret here.
That's exactly right. I'm officially endorsing the secret.
Yeah, but with those slop facts, it's like we think of Dan and Will and so on purely in terms of, oh, these are these fantastic players in the context of Big Brother. You never think about, oh, well, they're human, they're players just like everyone else. And so, yeah, they're going to be have-nots occasionally. They're going to have to eat slop and sleep on these cots or whatever. Like, it never really registers for them in the way that it does with other players, because you're not used to thinking about them as mortals almost.
Right. I mean, we see Will, there's actually a segment in this week of his back is killing him because he's so malnourished, and he tried to pick up Mike Boogie to celebrate him winning the veto, and like Kaser's trying to crack his back and so forth, and that's about as human as Will ever gets over the course of both of his Big Brother seasons in terms of like physical vulnerability or being in a position other than I'm totally above all of this and in on the joke. Like, it's the only time Will ever is complaining in earnest and not just to bring other people down.
As a professional chiropractor, can you explain to me this whole walking on people's backs thing? Because this seems like I watch this and I cringe. Like, I physically recoil. It seems so it seems so easy for something to go badly wrong, right?
Okay.
Like you put one foot in the wrong place and now they don't have a spine anymore.
So as someone who recently turned 30 years old and still plays on a softball team, I learned a lot about having your back cracked over the course of this summer, and having someone walk on your back feels outstanding. It's just got to be the right size person.
Well, this is what I'm talking about. Like, if it's Chicken George getting involved, right? Like, it seems like my Boogie might actually get Medevac this time, or, you know, the two of them might not last the whole season.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing that concerned me more during this segment was Kacer was down there like he was a chiropractor, like, let me stretch you out, like, let me crack your back, as if he knows what he's doing. And then he says in confessional, yeah, I saw a guy do this one time, and I think I could.
I watched a YouTube video, and I'm all set.
Right. No, like, I guarantee Will, just like through osmosis in medical school, has more knowledge of chiropractory than Kacer does.
Yeah, chiropractitude? No, that can't be it. But yeah, Kacer just seems inherently trustworthy, right? Like, he doesn't seem like the type to just do something without knowing about it, and yet here we are.
Right,
Like, maybe if it had been someone who he maybe has more trust in or likes a little bit more, he would hold back and let the qualified professionals get involved. But with Will, it's like, if something goes wrong, then... Well, that's unfortunate, but, you know, he could have seen it coming.
Yeah, I mean, Kacer, I think, is someone where if he just says it with enough confidence, like he knows what he's doing when he wants to crack your back, I don't think I would put up any kind of fight. Although, if it was like Chicken George, I think I would have some reservations. I would ask to see some kind of documentation, see some diplomas about where he got this kind of knowledge. But, all right, so let's get into, now that Janelle has this veto, we have to now put up a replacement nominee, since, of course, she's going to be coming down. Kacer and Howie are the obvious choices as the rest of Season 6, given that James is already up there. And we know she promised Howie up on the spider web that he would be totally safe. So it seems like Kacer, by process of elimination, is just going to wind up on the block automatically. Although, we do get this fake out that maybe it could be Marcellus, now that everyone is mad at him about the prizes. And it really did seem like people were mad at him. It seemed like there was genuine animosity about Marcellus and just kind of his, especially when they think that he's just gobbling up prizes without really putting himself out there in terms of the game, him just kind of floating through to this point.
How much do you think this sets up his eviction at the hands of Janelle accidentally in the following week? Was it easier for Chilltown to drive up all of this resentment against Marcellus on the back of this veto competition?
Yeah, I definitely think that this could be a big difference maker in terms of how Marcellus ended up getting evicted the following week, where, like we were talking about, you can't ask for a better person than Marcellus to have in that competition to pin everything on, and it really does feel like the rest of the house wasn't thrilled with him for what they thought was taking prizes and just kind of continuing to float his way through the game without putting himself out there too much. I certainly could see how this helped set things up for his eventual unanimous eviction the following week. I don't see how you can say that this didn't play a role in that. All right, so as mentioned, let's get into now we have Kacer go up on this block. Marcellus ends up fading the nomination here, and I agree with this. I actually don't think this is even a debatable decision on Danielle's part. I don't think you can allow for the possibility of anything happening where all four people from Season 6 are there and playing in the next HOH.
Yeah, you took your shot at Season 6. They're going to remember that. Even if they might be glad that, you know, I think Kacer might have some gratitude that you didn't evict him, but they know, and they will remember, and if one of them wins, you're still going to be their primary target. And I think you lose a lot of credibility in the house as well. Even if people wouldn't mind the idea of Marcellus going, if you had your one shot at Season 6 and you took it and then you back down at the last moment and you don't follow through, I think you lose that ability to sell yourself to the other floaters, to Chilltown, as someone who can be trusted to do what they're doing.
Totally. So Kacer, unfortunately, Dom, for America, is going to be our backdoor target here. He's on the block against James, who has been just a plant to be up there all along, so that one of Janelle or Kacer would leave sitting next to him. Kacer, it's actually kind of sad, where Kacer is scrambling for his life and thinks he pulls in Chicken George and then realizes, like, oh my god, to even have a chance to stay, I need to get Chilltown to vote with me. Like, for it to all hinge on Chilltown to keep Kacer safe at the end of his run is just such a sad way for Kacer to go out when they reject him on that. But anyway, let's get into parting thoughts, I suppose, first on Kacer, now that he is about to leave the Big Brother house for the third time in one calendar year.
I think the scene that really encapsulates all of this for me is Kesa has this diary entry saying that he has reservations about campaigning against James, and those reservations are not mutual. There is no this is not a two-way street. And to me, it's Kesa. He wants to be Dr. Will. He wants to go head-to-head with Dr. Will. He has these kind of affectations about it. But ultimately, I think he just... Maybe he's not cutthroat enough. Maybe he's too cutthroat in the wrong way. I don't quite know. He just... Something isn't working for Kesa. And as I said earlier, I think he is actually a much better player than these two performances would lead you to believe, or three performances if you want to count BB6 twice. But yeah, it is... kind of strange that one of the most iconic players at this point in the franchise is a three-time pre-jury boot.
Yeah, I actually thought it was interesting. Kesa got a pretty harsh kind of goodbye message sequence. Julie really was giving him the full breakdown on how everything got kind of flipped on him and how duped he got. And I want to play this clip of the ending sequence of Kesa's goodbye messages here from Boogie, Will, and James.
You should have got down with Chilltown earlier. I tried to tell you something that you're going to see very shortly, and that's that you could not trust your boy James.
I hate to say this, but somehow I told you so just doesn't cut it. I told you James was going to peel off, and he did. With me. For the time being, I have James, and, well, he stabbed you in the back.
I could no longer sit back and watch Janelle single-handedly destroy our group. Her selfishness and her stupidity... we're taking our team to the path of destruction. I gave you guys 4 weeks of chances, and you stabbed me in the back every chance you got, so I had to take action into my own hands.
And that goodbye message from James, really, that is the quintessential kind of James approach to these situations, where it's he is owning his game. He likes the fact that he made this move. He likes being in this new alliance, this secret alliance that's dominating the house. But he still feels the need to kind of justify it, to give this narrative where actually this was your fault the whole time. It wasn't me making a move. It was something I was forced to do by Janelle. And if it wasn't for Janelle, then everything would have been fine.
No, I mean, he literally says, you guys had 4 weeks to earn my trust and you blew it, so this had to happen, essentially.
Yeah, and I buy the for him. Like, that makes sense. That is what he was feeling. But I think to Kesa, it seems kind of disingenuous. And we see Kesa says... When Julie lists off all the things that James was saying about Janelle in particular, and more on that next week, certainly, Kesa says he was disappointed to hear what James said, which I think that is the strongest form of criticism that Kesa can ever give. Like, if you insulted his religion, if you told him you hated him, and then you evicted him, he'd be like... Well, I'm not too sure about that. That's a little bit disappointing.
Like, right. I mean, if you could ask Kesa about Donald Trump, and he would be like, you know, I think I did... He's got some slightly flawed ideas from time to time.
Yeah. Right. It's maybe you need to have that kind of outward passion, right? Maybe you need to be hating the people that you should be hating in order to make people think you're on their side. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, to go back to why I think James perhaps felt the need to be this blunt, I think it was because he wanted to give Kesa, like, the real reason. Like, maybe part of it was James wanting to send the message that you kind of brought this on yourself, but I do also think it was James feeling like Kesa was owed an explanation for why things got turned on him.
Yeah, I think I don't think James had any resentment towards Kesa, right? I think there was no bad blood there, at least as James saw it. It was more of like, if only it hadn't been for Janelle and Harry, I guess by extension, like if it had just been James and Kesa coming back from season six, I think the two of them would have worked perfectly fine together. But it was like having to manage that whole foursome that really dragged everything down and then blew it up.
Yeah. Well, Julie will have more with Kesa tomorrow on The Early Show. And this week, Dom, in classic CBS shows that they're promoting on these old seasons that are now canceled, The Early Show from 1999 to 2012, a solid run there. I went on the Wikipedia for this to get some facts about this. This was CBS's ninth attempt at a morning show to compete with NBC's Today and ABC's Good Morning America, both of which have been running seamlessly since 1952 and 1975, respectively. CBS not able to get it going in the morning department. And actually, what's the morning show landscape like on British television, Dom? Is it the same kind of low-key fluff human interest news stories, or what do they do on TV in the morning in England?
Basically, yeah. I mean, it's different here when you have a state broadcaster, essentially. So you have, like, the BBC Morning News and some of the early morning shows. And, yeah, it's the same formula that you see everywhere else. It's just the same kind of, like, human interest stuff, pretty light, not that engaging or interesting, but just something to have on in the background as you're watching breakfast, I think, is the idea. But it's, yeah, there's really nothing else you can do with that platform, right? Like, it's always going to be the same. But why do you think it is that CBS's repeated attempts at this have just flopped so badly?
Because CBS, as you will find to be a theme throughout all of their programming, gives their audience virtually no intellectual credit. I would say Survivor is the only CBS show I watch at this point. I didn't hate the first season of Life in Pieces, although I didn't go back and keep up with it. I would say other than that, the last comedy on CBS that I thought was worth watching was the first three seasons of How I Met Your Mother, and then that show realized it was on CBS and completely phoned it in for the next 5 years. So I don't know. I think CBS has an issue with this in general, and this is why, I don't know if they would call it an issue, is the problem that arises for me is, while CBS does not put out the best content, in my opinion, a lot of what they put out is often the highest rated stuff. Like, The Big Bang Theory is the number one comedy.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I think, like, NCIS and Criminal Minds are always the number one drama, or what, CSI was always the number one drama. Like, it's always CBS getting the number one stuff.
How dare you impugn the good name of Criminal Minds like that? Although, on the subject of Criminal Minds, I do like how these seasons of Big Brother date themselves when you have those adverts for other CBS shows at the bottom of the screen. So it felt like weirdly intrusive when you're watching an episode and like this ad for Survivor Guatemala just comes on the bottom. I know, for one of the earlier seasons.
So you're getting like the Mandy Patinkin Criminal Minds ads on you?
Yeah. Yeah, like I had no conception of how long that show had been going for. Like, I thought it was like a late 2000s kind of product, but instead this is like vintage old school Criminal Minds, and like every actor who was on the show at that point, except Reed, is just gone. So, yeah, as I said before, if you're interested in a Criminal Minds podcast, I know that there are certain people out there that Colin knows who could contribute to that. So
absolutely
let him know,
not.
Regan.
It's not happening. It's off. So.
Okay. All right. If there's enough pressure, you know, anything is possible.
All right, Dom. Let's, I guess, move on from Kacer. Another pre-jury finish for here him. Another pre-jury finish here for him. But we've been through, I think, enough why Kacer may have that happen to him a little more often than most, given just his style of play. Still, you hate to see it happen to, I think, a guy who, by all accounts, is just tremendously nice 24/7. But we will move on, and we will get a segment about the house guests being startled all week as, like, ghosts pop up in the mirrors as we lead into a trivia head of household competition about they had, like, previous season contestants like Bunky and several others who I'm currently spacing on pop up behind like the walls of the house, and they will use like the timing and location of all of that for a trivia competition, which is won by Erica here, which is a potentially exciting twist. But Dom, an even more exciting twist is that the buzzers are malfunctioning all over the place, and as people are getting eliminated, there are several complaints about like, what the hell, I hit my buzzer, it didn't register properly or whatever. And for the first time, and I believe still the only time in Big Brother history, they replay this head of household competition, because Big Brother is about nothing if not fairness.
Yeah, and there are some conspiracy theories surrounding this as well. So I will get into some more detail on those next week. So if you're partial to any of that, or if you want to hear this montage of everyone heading to Nell, then you can tune in for that too. And also, it's yet another very exciting and eventful week, right? You have Janelle in what Ian Terry described last week as one of the worst spent HOH reigns in Big Brother history, and it's hard to disagree with him, evicting seemingly her former best friend in the house in Marcellus, and yet another fantastic piece of work by Chilltown, and it's just another great week to cap off what I think is a perfect first half of the season.
I totally agree. I can't wait to get into it. And furthermore, Dom, at the end of this episode, after Erica is temporarily the HOH for about an hour or so, we get Julie calling everyone to the backyard to tease to them, a new special power is about to be unleashed within the game. One of everyone's eligible for it. One of you is going to get it. You're only going to have one shot each to submit your answer. We'll tell you more about that and how all that's going to go when we get into week 6 next week. Very excited, mostly at the opportunity to finally get to play an audio clip of Allison Grodner over the loudspeaker saying, house guests, this is Allison. As we know, fairness is of the utmost concern here at Big Brother. I'm never going to stop playing. I'm going to start working that into other podcasts that we do. That's going to be my favorite drop ever.
I can't wait.
Yeah. All right. Well, until next time, he is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. Email us your thoughts on this or any other things you would like us to podcast about, domandcolin@gmail.com. Of course, this entire BB7 series is going to be free as a promotion to launch our Patreon campaign. To find out more about that and to get in on the future seasons that we do that are going to be patron only, it is patreon.com/domandcolin. All right, we will get you guys out of here. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you next Tuesday. Take care, everybody.